Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 14 hours GMT on the 1st of March, these are our main stories. More than 30 people are dead after two trains collided in Greece. The head of the FBI says COVID-19 most likely originated from a Chinese lab. A Nigerian opposition party has said it will mount a legal challenge to Bola Tinubu's victory in the presidential election. Also in this podcast...
I ate worms, insects. You have no idea what I had to go through all these days. I thank God very much because he gave me a new life.
A Bolivian man missing in the Amazon for a month recounts his experience. Hours after the horrific nighttime collision of two trains in central Greece, the station master in the nearby city of Larissa, who's in charge of signalling, has been arrested and charged with manslaughter by negligence, according to police. He denies any wrongdoing and is blaming the accident on a possible technical failure. Rescuers are still sifting through the wreckage in the hope of finding survivors. As we record this podcast, at least 36 people are known to have died, but the fire service has warned that number might increase. Dozens more have been injured, some seriously. Survivors have told of a nightmarish 10 seconds as their train carriage overturned and was then engulfed in flames. This passenger described his experience.
We heard a big bang. It was 10 nightmarish seconds. We were turning over in the wagon until we fell on our sides and until the commotion stopped. Then there was panic. Cables everywhere. Fire. The fire was immediate. As we were turning over, we were being burned. Fire was right and left.
Another survivor, who was in the fourth carriage of the passenger train, told of the moment of the crash.
We broke the windows with our backs. All I personally remember is feeling a very strong braking, and suddenly I see sparks and flames on the sides of the windows, and then a sudden stop. This made us all panic, and we just wanted to get out as soon as possible, so we tried to break the glass. Some of us who were near windows, we broke them, we got out.
The Greek Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, has been visiting the scene of the crash. I got more from our Europe correspondent, Nick Beek.
The Greek Prime Minister has just said the country will now enter a three-day period of mourning. That means all public celebrations will be cancelled and flags on public buildings will fly at half-mast to mark and remember the people who have died in this awful incident. And as we heard from that survivor, they paint a picture of an awful scene just before midnight last night, this intercity service that had left the Greek capital Athens heading to the north and then appearing to have this head-on collision with a freight train at great speed. And the regional governor of the place where this took place has confirmed that the two trains were on the same track. Now, in terms of how this could have happened, it's not clear at this point whether it was an error on the part of one or two of the drivers, whether it was any sort of other human mistake or some sort of signalling failure. But certainly some people are saying this is the worst tragedy on the Greek railway that they can remember. And also some union officials have said at this point they've got no idea why this tragedy has occurred.
Rescuers are still at the scene. I mean, is it still a rescue operation?
I think it would be characterised as such. But I mean, I'm just having a look at some of the images now, Valerie, and they really speak for themselves. The mangled wreckage and the fire that took hold. This really was an inferno that ripped through the train last night. And that same public official, was saying that the first four carriages of the passenger train were derailed. The first two have been almost entirely destroyed, to use his words. And that's as a result of the collision, the force of the collision, but also the fire that ripped through. And when you look at some of the pictures, it's incredible that some people have managed to get out alive, saying that they broke windows with luggage, and also they faced this dilemma. Should they jump onto the track, or should they try and move to the back of the train? Clearly, lots of people got out, but many, many more have lost their lives. And we're just hearing, actually, that it's thought a lot of students were on this particular train going home to university after spending a Greek Orthodox holiday with their families.
Nick Beek. Since the start of the pandemic, one key question has gone unanswered. How exactly did the first known outbreak of the coronavirus emerge in the Chinese city of Wuhan? Now, the FBI director in the US has said he believes it spread from a laboratory in China. In an interview with Fox News, Christopher Wray said his agency had held that assessment for some time, but he didn't provide new scientific evidence to back it up.
The FBI has for quite some time now assessed that the origins of the pandemic are most likely a potential lab incident in Wuhan. Let me step back for a second. You know, the FBI has folks, agents, professionals, analysts, virologists, microbiologists, etc., who focus specifically on the dangers of biological threats, which include things like novel viruses like COVID, and the concerns that in the wrong hands, some bad guys, a hostile nation state, a terrorist, a criminal, the threats that those could pose. So here you're talking about a potential leak from a Chinese government-controlled lab that killed millions of Americans, and that's precisely what that capability was designed for.
Beijing has denied a lab leak in Wuhan, calling the allegation defamatory. Let's get more from our correspondent in Beijing, Stephen McDonnell.
There's no evidence as such. He basically said it was all classified and everyone needs to take his word for it. But I should add that there seems to be division within the intelligence community in the US. That is, some agencies have said lab leak. Others have said there's more evidence to point towards a sort of natural progression towards the virus. Either way, China's foreign ministry spokesperson Mao Ning said that given that the FBI and that these US intelligence community overall has, in her words, a history of misdeeds involving fraud and deception, that their conclusions regarding the origins of COVID are not worth anything. It's interesting, though, she said that this should be left for the scientists. It's a complex scientific issue, shouldn't be politicised. But then she went on to repeat these, frankly, these conspiracy theories about a global source of the virus involving US military bases, especially Fort Detrick. So on the one hand, the Chinese government's saying don't politicise this, but it then went on to politicise it. So here we are, we're just stuck in this never-ending round of kind of tit-for-tat accusations between Beijing and Washington, and no closer to the real origins. Unfortunately, the World Health Organization was supposed to have another trip to China, was supposed to have another inquiry. That all seems to have stopped in its tracks as well.
Because that's the essence of it, isn't it? Will China cooperate with an independent investigation into this?
Well, again, there's great debate about this amongst scientists. It has all become so politicised. Some of those who were on the last WHO trip to China were, I suppose you could call them friends of the Chinese government in a way, or at least the Chinese government saw it that way because they wanted them put on to the trip. And so there's been accusations that it wasn't as thorough as it should have been. Now, they would say, sure, we've worked in China, we are professional scientists and we did our best and that's what we've come up with. So, like I say, extremely politicised. The US government says China is hindering the investigation, but at the moment there really is no investigation as far as I can see. The WHO is the body which should be leading it. There's supposed to have been another trip, you know, another team put together to look into this. And where is the trip? Where's the new team? No closer, really, to getting to the origins of it.
Stephen McDonnell. In Nigeria, the president-elect is appealing for unity after his victory in Saturday's election. Bola Tinubu called for the nation to come together following opposition claims that the poll was a sham.
It is one country that we must build together. We work together to put broken pieces together. We must work for the unity, happiness and harmony.
The Nigerian Labour Party says it will mount a legal challenge against the victory. The election was mired in accusations of fraud and failure of the electronic voting system, with calls for the poll to be rerun, alleging the results had been manipulated. Mr. Tinubu said any lapses were relatively few and would not have changed the outcome. Raza Iqbal has been speaking to the European Union's chief observer in the election, Barry Andrews, about the allegations.
Broadly speaking, we were able to see that there was evidence of vote buying. It's too early for us to conclude how widespread this was. Our message is very clear that we would encourage any complaints to be brought through the appropriate legal channels. But our observations certainly bear out significant shortcomings in the electoral process.
The Electoral Commission, which oversees the elections, has been accused of all kinds of malfeasance, in particular being very slow in uploading the results, which suggests to the opposition parties that somehow the numbers have been manipulated.
The viewing platform was sold as a game changer for allowing for real-time visibility of the uploading of results. But by 10 o'clock on the day of the election, no results had been uploaded whatsoever. And there was a clear anomaly between the fact that votes for the presidential election were not uploaded, whereas votes for the legislative elections were uploaded. And that created a vacuum of information. INEC didn't explain what had caused this until late in the afternoon of the following day. Now, it remains to be seen whether any of the accusations about manipulation can be borne out. We would encourage all political participants to take the complaints through the appropriate legal channels.
Are you confident that there is an independent way in which people can challenge what it is that they see as having been voter fraud?
We did identify the fact that an awful lot of legal cases have been taken by the political participants about candidate selection over the last 6 months. So clearly, by taking these cases, they have faith that the judiciary will be in a position to make an independent assessment. Nevertheless, there are shortcomings in the judiciary. There are too many cases. There are not enough judges. But the alternative is not something that anybody should contemplate.
We spoke to somebody who told us that large numbers of people in River State had been disenfranchised, that they were being prevented from voting because the polling station had been closed. And part of the reason was because there were all these delays from earlier on in the day. To what extent was sheer disenfranchisement taking place?
Well, there was widespread problems about late opening of polling units. They were supposed to be open at 8:30 and close at 2:30. But in many instances, they didn't open until midday and later. People were still voting into the night, past midnight in some cases, and clearly this impacted on people's ability to vote.
Barry Andrews. In Ukraine, President Zelensky has given a stark warning about Moscow's push to capture the city of Bakhmut, which he's previously described as the country's fortress. In his nightly address, Mr. Zelensky said President Putin's forces were shattering anything that could be used to shield the area's defenders from the onslaught. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, who's in central Ukraine, gave us this update.
Over the past month during our assignment here in Ukraine, I've been inside the city twice and also with Ukrainian forces on the outskirts. And I think, you know, President Zelensky is running out of ways to describe how difficult it is. Night after night, he's talking about the situation in Bakhmut and how bad it has become, how intense the fighting is. He said last night that the enemy was sending constant waves to storm Ukrainian positions, that Russia was not counting the number of people it was losing in the fight. Ukraine is claiming that in the last 5 days, 800 Russian soldiers have been killed in and around Bakhmut. Now, we cannot confirm those figures, and we also don't know how many Ukrainian troops have been killed over the same period. But we do know that the fighting is intense and becoming worse, and that the Russians are concentrating on trying to take this city, moving in, attempting to move in from the north. There's been a sustained Russian bid to get control of Bakhmut, which is an industrial city, a salt mining city, which used to have about 70,000 people. Now, we were in the city back in September several times when the shelling was already very intense and the population had more or less emptied out. It has become a symbol of Ukrainian resistance. It has been referred to as by President Zelensky as Ukraine's fortress. And of course, the fact that Ukrainian forces resisted for so long became a real theme here and a source of pride and gave rise to this social media slogan, Bakhmut Holds. But there is also a strategic importance to hanging on to Bakhmut. It's not just about politics and symbolism. When we were inside the city, Ukrainian forces stressed to us that by continuing to defend it, they were bogging down the Russians, they were tying them down, they were making it difficult, if not impossible, for them to move on from Bakhmut. Now, if the Russians did manage to take the city, there is high ground just outside Bakhmut. They could move their artillery weapons to that high ground, and from there they could strike closer to bigger cities here.
Orla Guerin. Later in the programme.
Je t'aime, je t'aime. Oh oui, je t'aime.
Remembering the iconic French musician Serge Gainsbourg. A Bolivian man has recounted his experience of being missing in the Amazon for a month, one of the longest known periods someone has survived in the rainforest alone. Jonathan Acosta was reported missing by friends he'd become separated from during a hunting trip in late January. He was found by rescue teams last Saturday. Andrea Cheng has compiled this report.
So who got the El Negro?
Chants of "You are a black champion" as Jonathan Acosta made his way home. Videos published online by Bolivian media shows him being assisted to walk by what looks like medical personnel, his face swollen. Mr. Costa spoke about his ordeal after being admitted to hospital.
It's unbelievable. I couldn't believe that people were still looking for me after all this time.
The 30-year-old told journalists he'd walked 40 kilometers to find civilization, but realized he was going round in circles. It rained half the time he was lost, he said. He used his rubber boots to collect whatever rainwater he could, but when the skies dried up, he had to drink his own urine.
I ate worms, insects. You have no idea what I had to go through all these days. I thank God very much because he gave me a new life.
While 30 days is one of the longest times a human is known to have survived alone in the Amazon, in 2021, a Brazilian pilot survived 38 days in the jungle after crash landing.
Andrew Ochiang. The French singer and songwriter Serge Gainsbourg died in 1991. He was a celebrated figure in French culture, always happy to provoke and cause a scandal. Outside France, he was known for his love life, in particular his relationships with the actresses Brigitte Bardot and Jane Birkin. An exhibition has just opened at the Pompidou Centre in Paris about Gainsbourg's work, and Vincent Dowd went to see it.
Je t'aime, je t'aime. Oh oui, je t'aime.
Outside France, Serge Gainsbourg is associated above all with the song Je T'aime. In 1968, the version with Jane Birkin became a mini scandal. The BBC banned it for being too sexy. In Paris, the new exhibition at the National Library reminds us this was the original version opposite Brigitte Bardot. Gainsbourg was admired for reinventing Gallic cool for the rock era. The exhibition's co-curator is Anatole Magyar.
The basis of the exhibition is the 550 song titles that are written on the facades of the exhibition. They're all there from, you know, 1954 until 1990. A lot of them are in our collective culture as French people, but also internationally with songs like Je t'aime non plus, Bonnie and Clyde, Aux armes, etc. These are songs that have had a major, major impact here in France.
Alors voilà, Clyde a une petite amie. Elle est belle et son prénom c'est
Bonnie.
In 1968, the song Bonnie and Clyde was a product of Gainsbourg's brief relationship with Brigitte Bardot. Caroline Reynaud of the Library says no one in the 1950s would have predicted Serge Gainsbourg would turn out an admired musician and writer.
He had this very particular way to sing at the audience, and at first it was a disaster.
He kind of probably always knew that he had some kind of a destiny to fulfill. It's one of the, how do you say, the contradictions of this personality, you know, very shy and at the same time wanting to express something.
Oddly, what the utterly French Gainsbourg sometimes expressed himself in was the English language.
Serge Gainsbourg was one of the first to work really the French language and to make it sound proper with rock. French has a problem with the way it sounds. He was one of the first to bring inside French language some English words. And there was this song called Comic Strip, we all know in France, with all this shbam, pop, plop.
Une bouteille de
fluid makeup.
He used to use words for the sounds of words, not for the meaning, like the poets. This song, Comment te diras-tu, meaning how to say goodbye, it's rhymes in X, and we don't have many words in X in France. So he had to cut the words. Sous aucun prétexte, je ne veux avoir de réflexe malheureux. Il faut que tu m'expliques un peu mieux comment te dire adieu.
The new exhibition centers on Serge Gainsbourg as writer, but he was one of the most popular French celebrities of his generation.
His shyness was one of the elements that drove him to, you know, this very provocative character that, you know, we see appear from the 80s. As with, you know, any good double, especially literary ones, at the end, you know, the act finishes by taking over the initial personality.
Serge Gainsbourg is remembered now for some very ill-tempered TV appearances and, when he was young, for attracting some very beautiful women. The exhibition at the Pompidou Centre wants us to remember as well a prolific and inventive writer.
A soupçon of oulala there from Vincent Doubt. Now to Norway, where environmentalists are trying to protect the indigenous rights of the Sami people. They're demonstrating against wind turbines being erected on pastures used by Sami reindeer herders. Norway's Supreme Court ruled 2 years ago that the turbines violated traditional Sami cultural practices. The protesters have erected barricades outside government offices in the capital Oslo to try and stop the plans. The Norwegian Sami activist and singer Ella Marie Hekta Isaksen is among those protesting, and she spoke to Catherine Bjerahanga about their aims and what the area is like.
This is an area called Fosenjarke in Sami. It's a place where traditional reindeer herding has been important for many, many years. And right now, the Norwegian government is failing to respect their claims to their own lands, and they have put up 151 illegal wind turbines in the middle of the reindeer herders' important area. So it's heartbreaking.
Yes, the Supreme Court has already ruled against the wind turbine project. So how come it's still going ahead?
Well, as we all know, capital rules and the money invested in this is massive. The government has taken a risk here. They have given permission to build this wind park long before the questions raised by the courts were answered. So after the High Court ruling, the windmills were already set up and the government had a big problem. They don't want to take them down because of the big investment put in it.
And so this is really an interesting story, an interesting situation, because obviously on the one hand, wind turbines, green energy is what a lot of people are calling for when it comes to helping the environment. But on the other hand, you have indigenous rights, people connected to the land, saying that they will be affected by this project. And the famous Swedish climate campaigner Greta Thunberg has visited your camp. What did she say? How did you feel about that?
Yeah, it's so nice for us to have Greta here supporting us. Obviously, this shows how the world's eyes are now set on the government in Norway. Of course, we need renewable energy, and this is not a protest against renewable energy. This is a protest against renewable energy being produced in a way that's harmful for the indigenous peoples and that it's actually violating our human rights. So that is what this protest is about. And I think it's important to remember that if we're going to solve the climate crisis, we're going to need the indigenous peoples. And in many situations, we've seen how indigenous rights actually protect nature. And we also have to remember that we're in a nature crisis and that restoring nature will also help solve the climate crisis.
We only have a couple of minutes and I really want to play some of your music, Ella Marie. So
nice.
Just tell us about some of the songs that you sing about Sami culture and whether you sing to your fellow protesters.
We have been using especially the Sami traditional way of not only singing but expressing ourselves, joik, a lot here during the protests. When the police come to pick us up and arrest us, we use our songs to motivate each other and to remind each other that they're not alone and that we're here for each other. So the songs and our culture has been a really important part of this.
And finally, police in Peru have made a macabre discovery. Officers were on patrol in a park in the southern city of Puno when they saw a man with a mummy, which is believed to be between 600 and 800 years old. With more, here's Daniel Mann.
Julio Cesar Bermejo, who was with his friends, had been carrying the pre-Hispanic mummy in a cool bag, which he used to keep food to take to people's homes when he was a delivery driver. The mummified human was wrapped in bandages. Mr. Bermejo, who is 26, even has a name, Juanita. I take care of her. I maintain her. She's like my spiritual girlfriend. He adds, at home, she's in my room. She sleeps with me. However, a specialist at Peru's Ministry of Culture says, it's not a Juanita, it's a Juan, as the mummy was a man who was at least 45 years old when he died. The ministry has now taken possession of the remains with the aim of protecting and preserving, it says, this heritage. Mr. Bermejo claims that his father brought the mummy home almost 30 years ago and denied that he was trying to sell it. Rather, he took it to the park last Saturday because his friends wanted to see it. An official said that Mr. Bermejo will remain in custody while the case is being investigated.
Daniel Mann. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Mike Adley. The producers were Olivia Noon and Beatrice de la Pava. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
This week on the podcast, Spark and Fire, writer Susan Orlean.
I had no idea why anyone would steal orchids.
Susan tells the story of writing The Orchid Thief.
A door just opened onto a world that I didn't even know existed. And I thought, I need to know more.
On Spark and Fire, creators share their stories to fuel your creativity. Spark and Fire is a Wait What original in partnership with the BBC. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts.